Welcome to the 11th episode of Transit, the podcast on migration history at the Department of Contemporary History at the University of Vienna. My name is Franziska Lamp, and together with my colleague Philipp Strobel, we have created this podcast to talk to experts from the field about historical perspectives on migration, flight and displacement. Today's guest is G. Daniel Cohn. He is a historian and associate professor at the Department of History at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Prior to this, he completed his PhD at the NYU in New York City. His research and extensive publications are dedicated to the fields of modern European and French history, human rights, international law, and migration studies. In 2011, he published his monograph, In War's Wake, Europe's Displaced Persons in the Postwar Order, with Oxford University Press, which has become a standard reference work in the field of historical migration research. This spring semester, he holds the Sir Peter Ustinov Guest Professorship at the Department of Contemporary History at the University of Vienna. Thank you so much for being here, Daniel Cohn. Thanks for agreeing to be part of this podcast, and I'm really looking forward to the episode today.
Thank you, Francesca. It's a pleasure to be here.
So my first question for you today would be, because of course, when we focus on migration history, flight, displacement, in this podcast, we talk a lot about the period after the Second World War, but of course, it's nothing that did only happen after the Second World War, but also before. So my question would be, how would you say does the international humanitarianism of the late 1940s and 1950s compare to the humanitarian aid in the aftermath of the First World War?
Yes, and thank you for this question. There is a line of continuity between refugee humanitarianism during and after World War I and refugee assistance, humanitarianism, and migration after World War II. The continuity is first and foremost in the magnitude of the effort needed. This is for the first time that Europe contemplated and experienced civilian displacement to such an extent. So there is, in a sense, a story that starts in 1914 and in the late 50s. But there are also differences. The differences are numerous. While humanitarianism, civilian humanitarianism, during World War I and World War II still belonged to the realm of charity humanitarianism, apolitical humanitarian, so to speak, and also unprofessional humanitarianism, we have in the 1940s, a turn to professional humanitarianism, but also a humanitarianism that is also related to a political project, and that project is the project of the Cold War West. And in that sense, the history of charity, right, or the history of relief, changes in content between the pre-war period and the post-war period. We're entering in 1945 the age of what we can call liberal professional humanitarianism in the West, with its specific agenda, and in which the refugee becomes the essential figure, the centerpiece of this project.
With my next question, I would like to move on more to contemporary times. In a paper of yours from 2006 titled The Politics of Recognition, you described the International Refugee Organization, the IRO, as a, quote, testing ground for the contemporary governance of political asylum in the West. What would you say is left of the post-war displacement experience today? What has changed? What are similarities to today? Maybe also with regard to the management of displaced populations, and of people on the move in general.
Right. So you mentioned an organization that perhaps our listeners do not know or are not aware of, the so-called International Refugee Organization, which had a short life. A few years after, between essentially 1947, 1948 till the early 1950s. But this was the first time that an international body not only provided assistance to refugees, but became a stakeholder in the politics of migration and of resettlement in the West. Evidently, the High Commissioners for Refugees was created much earlier in the early 1920s, and in the Nansen era, but its function was quite different than the IRO. So the IRO is, on one hand, a humanitarian organization, but it's also, in a sense, a political organization. And its political purpose was to answer one question, who is a legitimate refugee? So if something remains from this experience, it's pretty much that question, right? Who is a refugee and who is not? Who ought to receive protection and who does not? That is, in a sense, the main legacy of the IRO for the current period. Since then, and its successor organization, UNHCR, continued to work on these premises, on trying to ascertain, right, describe who is a true refugee, and trying to hound out or isolate the people who do not fall under the mandate of what a refugee is, and that mandate is, of course, the Geneva Refugee Convention. But there are, of course, a lot of differences. The IRO, you know, which essentially was tasked with finding victims of Hitler and victims of Stalin, or both, had an easy task, is that these victims were rather easily identifiable. Evidently, evaders existed at the time, but the notion of containment and the notion of protecting the system of asylum from false refugees, as we call them today, was not central to the organization, although part of it, the screening, so to speak, part of it, was already there. Today, we have, of course, a different system with a blurring of categories, with new categories of refugees, ranging from refugees from environmental disasters, from famine, evidently from war, to more traditional political refugees who are victims of oppression or victims of persecution. And a new category came into play, the category that we now know as migrant, which is a category that is much more confusing, so to speak, for the people in charge to declare who is a refugee and who is not, because it's a very fluid and ambivalent categorization that make the whole business of triage and selection much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for this, insights into links to contemporary times and this new emerging category of the migrant, which I think is already, you can already see the emergence of this term already in the under the mandate period of the IRO, but it's, of course, much more important today. Maybe let's focus more on the history of human rights development in general, which is an important research focus of yours. In your academic work, you frequently mention the term human rights revolution, especially with regard to the 1940s. Could you maybe tell our listeners more about this term, human rights revolution, and also how it connects to the millions of post-war refugees, homeless, stateless people after World War II?
Right. So the term human rights revolution is very contested. And it's particularly contested since scholars, Samuel Moyne in the United States in particular, starting to offer a counter-narrative to an idea that had taken hold, especially after 1989 in the West, is that 1945 is the moment where a new form of politics emerges, which has to do with the protection of individual human rights after fascism and after totalitarianism. The revisionist school, and oftentimes with great reason, argue that that moment was far less revolutionary than we ought to think. It did not address colonial subjects. It was Eurocentric in essence, since it emanated from a small community of legal scholars, often emigre scholars, sometimes Jewish, both in the United States and Europe. And it addressed a human rights situation that was essentially European. the massive refugee crisis that followed the Second World War. I still use the term in my work, if anything, to reproduce or to put myself in the shoes of the people who believed that they were engaged in a revolutionary process. And these were mostly diplomats and legal minds who had one project in mind, and that project was to curtail, limit the prerogative of the almighty states to protect human rights which they now, in a sense, in a revolutionary way, wanted to put at the level of the individual, a shift from collective rights to individual human rights. So it's a project, in a sense, that is Euro-liberal and reconnects with the tradition of European liberalism. It's not a universal project, but in the context of post-fascism, post-Nazism, and Soviet totalitarianism, it was revolutionary enough to oppose a language of rights to mechanisms or regimes that transgressed them, violated them, or did not recognize them. And again, in this story, the refugee, with Hannah Arendt, it's quite evident, the refugee is the test case or the centerpiece of this whole human rights enterprise that starts in 1945. So just to summarize, we don't need to idealize this moment. We don't need to make it more than it was. But in the context of 1945, there was indeed a revolutionary element to redeem the individual, to protect the individual after the multiple wounds, so to speak, that it had, the individual subject, it had suffered since the 1930s in Europe.
Yeah, I really liked especially this part where you just told us about this this importance of the individual and of the individual persecution experience. And I think we can see this a lot if we look at files by the IRO, which really focus on every single biography and which really try to trace those moments of persecution for each individual, which is sometimes also very difficult to prove if you don't have any certificates with you. So I think what you just mentioned, this individualization maybe of human rights, is really key for this period of the IRO mandate. When we are already talking about the IRO, which is a UN organization or was a UN organization as well, maybe we can talk more about this connection of TP history, which you already mentioned a bit now, also with Hannah Arendt, the refugee as a test case, kind of the linkage between TP history and UN humanitarianism. How would you say, can we more easily maybe understand UN humanitarianism if we look at the TP story? And how was the DP context, do you think, important for the establishment of the UN humanitarian system?
Right. So in my work, I used the DP experience, which is now quite well known, not only because of a generation of scholars of my generation, so to speak, but because of new students and new researchers, and you belong to this new cohort. So it's fair to say that the DP story is much more known today than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago, by all means. But I think that what went on in Europe at a continental level after World War I, but even more so after World War II, had implications for the long-term history of humanitarianism in the West. And I think we touched upon that in your first question. But first of all, a new category of workers, humanitarian workers, who are now increasingly professionalized, people who actually become international civil servants. This category existed prior to the war, but is much more prevalent after the Second World War, emerged on the international scene. Together with that, of course, is the multiplication of humanitarian NGOs, which exist prior to World War II, but kind of proliferate after World War II in the West. And then there is the political project that is attached to humanitarianism in the 1950s. It's essentially to show to the world the benevolence of the West against the tyranny of the East, i.e. the European East, right? It's something that has to do with sort of the humanitarian aspect of European liberalism. And by the way, the story of Zionism here is enters the frame because resettlement to Israel is also part of this Euro-liberal project or Western liberal project after World War II. And for all these aspects, professionalizations, NGOs, but also the political project of the Cold War West, the displaced persons provide a test case, so to speak, a cohort of guinea pigs on which it's possible to experiment this new form of Western humanitarianism, which continues on all the way to the 1990s with the age of liberal humanitarianism. Right? So there is a story there that starts in 1945 and perhaps culminates with the R2P resolutions of the UN and the age of hyper-humanitarianism, of liberal interventionism, the 1990s and the early 2000s in the West.
Yeah, you just mentioned at the beginning of your answer this, yeah, the historiography on the peace and that it is growing in recent years or recent decades. And now, my final question would also focus on this, yeah, historiographic element. In a paper of yours called Remembering Postwar DPs, From Omission to Resurrection, you write exactly about that, about the, quote, disappearance of DPs from the scope of public history in the period between the 1950s until the 1990s. How would you explain this lack of historiography on this topic?
This lack of historiography up until the early 2000s. Yeah, this is an excellent question. There's no clear answer. But for a long time, the very notion of being a displaced person is something that people try to forget. There's nothing honorific with being a displaced person to live in camp. And for people who resettled across the world successfully, the point was to kind of transition to normality. In a sense, something that is, of course, we cannot compare the two experiences, but something that Holocaust survivors or concentration camp survivors tried to do for a long time, that is to say, to move on and to keep the personal histories for personal trauma or for personal stories. There's another aspect, another reason why the DP story never made sense is that never made sense, so to speak, as an object of history, is that it was fragmented by nationality or by ethnicity. So instead of talking about the DPs as a category, although we have that in Arendt, right? We have sort of micro histories of Lithuanians, of Ukrainians, of Poles, and of course of Jews. But these were historiographies and histories that did not really meet and did not create an historical question, right? The fragmentation of sort of experiences. Another aspect of it is that oftentimes the history of DPs was understood as the history of Jewish DPs. And that history of Jewish DPs was understood as the history of Holocaust survivors. So this particular DP moment, this refugee-ness, so to speak, was in a sense swallowed in the history of the Holocaust and its aftermath. Did not really constitute something that we can single out. And perhaps the last reason is that in Eastern Europe under communism, these DPs had no history. Right? This is not something that the Soviets wanted to perpetuate because the DPs, by definition, were people who tried to leave the Soviet orbit, not to return to the Soviet orbit. So that was also an Eastern erasure, so to speak, of this memory. And in the West, it was absorbed for the most part in the history of nationalities, or it became Holocaust history. And it seems to me that after 1989, and the whole process of Europeanizing European history, the whole sort of a rediscovery of the European historical agenda or the pan-European historical agenda made the DP story bubble up a little bit to the fore. But let's not forget that Europe in the 1990s experienced its first refugee crisis with the Yugoslav crisis. of war refugees, something that the European project was supposed to have eliminated, project of peace and of cosmopolitanism, and the very notion of refugees in Europe and refugees from Europe became once again relevant, right, with the crisis in the Balkans. And it's fair to say that at this moment, together with the revival and the, not even the revival, but the exponential growth of Holocaust historiography, that the DP story found a new place. In my work, I try to globalize in a sense that to not separate this story by nationality, even if talking about Jewish DPs is not always the same that talking about non-Jewish Polish DPs, for instance. But not right. Altogether, around 2000, there has been, that is 20, 25 years ago, there has been a movement of rediscovery of this experience, which culminated, I should say, around 2015 and the migrant crisis, when in the press, if you remember, a lot of journalists started their articles as Europe is experiencing displacement and upheaval unseen on the continent since 1945. And then suddenly the DP crisis, long forgotten, became a referent or a template for the so-called migration crisis of 2015 to the present.
Yeah, I think that's a great analysis of the different factors that led to this, yeah, historiographical gap, I would say. Maybe one thing would also be like the access to the archives, which grew in the recent years, or was possible in the recent years. Yeah, so actually that was my last question. Thank you so much for being here. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed being part of this podcast.
I enjoyed being here. Thank you, Franziska.
This was the 11th episode of Transit, the podcast on migration history. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you have comments, remarks, questions, just email us. Our email is transit.zeitgeschichte@univie.ac.at. Thanks for listening again, and until next time.